Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September the 3rd, 1999, and in Koinonia Fireside Room this morning is Cynthia Mo Libida's session called Market Myths and Alternative Visions. It's her fourth session. Let's listen in.
You buy into that, like it's really possible for that person to, like there's an equal possibility for all people to participate in that. I could work my way up from migrant farm worker to president of a major corporation, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, like they really have the same resources.
Mm-hmm,
there,
right.
There's really a community in the resources.
I think it's also called the Protestant work, I think.
Yeah.
So. Which are both related. And I think that that's a really important, I think you point to a very important function of an ideology. It not only tells us what to believe, but what to erase, what to ignore. And we're taught to ignore, by the American Dream thing, we're taught to ignore the legacy of racism, as though racism does not impact the capacity of an African-American boy born to a very poor family to reach the American dream. It teaches us to ignore racism. It teaches us to ignore the legacy of neocolonialism. Other thoughts about what we say? Yes, and then...
In some ways I see parallels to the drug epidemic in this nation. And there's a lot of ways we can deal with that, and we put a lot of emphasis on the drug lords and the smuggling and all that stuff, which is important, and we need to acknowledge that. But ultimately, it's me. And so part of the ideology here is that we believe, that we have every right to live as comfortably as we can. We deserve that, and we choose to be consumers. And we cannot consider voluntary insufficiency, we cannot consider simplicity in any significant way. And I think somewhere that's a level that oftentimes we don't look upon. We want to focus and blame those things which are important, and they need that blame, but yet does it come from ultimately? And I think that's just, we are choosing to do that because we think we have the right to live as well as we are able to live.
I think that is a truly important part of the ideology that runs life in this country. We do have the right to as much comfort as we can get. And I think that we could, and we're not going to, but we could stop right there and we could just play with that. I see it, the symbol of that to me is contemporary cars. Because now, if you buy a new car, what I see people buying is cars that are extraordinary comfort vehicles. You punch a button to open the door before you get there. You punch a button to do the windows and the locks. Your seat is contoured and custom made to be a veritable massage when you sit down in it. And that is the right. And that's what people get. That's what I see people driving around Seattle in. So regardless of what that means about use of resources, and regardless of the fact that those vehicles sometimes get 13 miles an hour of gas, consume gas, that notion that we have a right, of course now that I make more income, I'm going to remodel my kitchen. I need an, and it's not, it's just so pervasive, and it's good, compassionate, caring people. It's the kids' soccer coaches who devote their lives to these kids and who care and go to church and serve the neighbor and even take homeless people into their house sometimes. But this right to ongoing comfort we do need to look at.
There's no end to it.
Right.
Well, let me...
There's no end to it.
Woody, you wanted to make a suggestion too, and then I want to throw out a few more notions.
That the people should be paid according to their contribution, not according to their need. If you don't pay people according to the contribution that they make, then there's no incentive to do anything. If everybody just can sit around and get what they need without having to work, then there's no incentive in the system. So we need an incentive in the system to pay people inequitably according to their contribution. A doctor should be making more than a gardener.
That's very present, and it's somewhat distorting also, because then lawyers who pursue some of the most ridiculous things around get still paid more for their contribution. But that's very true, and that I think it gets behind the
I think that's part of this ideology.
Right, and that's that becomes concrete in the notion of a minimum wage as opposed to a living wage. Well, those are good. I would say that part of our task is to see, cut to the quick, what are human beings around us saying to ourselves? I'm going to throw out a few more parts of market ideology that I think are important. All of these are. And I'm not trying to hold up these five that I'm going to name, but I'm going to name them for our consideration anyway. I think one...
What's the snack down here?
One aspect of market ideology is a notion of who we are. In theological terms, a doctrine of the human. In ethical terms, our moral anthropology. Who we are as moral human beings. And I would suggest that the ideology underlying free market thought is that human beings are essentially autonomous individuals with unalienable rights to pursue self-interest, which is what you were saying, Alex, rather than essentially beings in community with a moral obligation to serve the common good. Those are two very different notions of what a human being is. We're essentially competitive rather than cooperative. We're consumeristic rather than spiritual. In economic life, people are motivated almost entirely by personal self-interest measured by personal economic gain. Those who own and consume the most are the most valued, the most important. Pardon me?
I was going to say, that's where it goes.
Uh-huh.
Is to that level.
Uh-huh.
Because our attitude is, I need to have this because, you know, the Jones has it, and if I don't, then I'm not going to be considered any kind of success or something like that. Gosh, I can't, like my home, if I've got these bad cupboards, I can't bring friends in.
Uh-huh.
I need to, you know, and it's this whole consumerism and the marketing and the advertising that says, if you don't have this, well, you're not successful and you're not smart and beautiful and
or loved.
Your worth has decreased. So capitalism also, you know, it says, it just forces you down this road. It says, this is where you need to be. And if you're not, you're not happy. And
you said it better than I could have said it. That whole moral anthropology does lead to that. It entraps us in that path of having in order to be one of the valuable people in our society.
And in that way, you can see a victim and you can see how we're doing ourselves.
And I think that's important. Last night we talked about, are we victims or are we oppressors? And we're both.
Yeah.
It is... Some aspects of this moral anthropology are more difficult to challenge than others. And I also don't want to set up an either or. You know, people will say, well, it's not maybe that we're cooperative rather than competitive, but both. But essentially the notion that we're essentially individuals rather than beings in community is a modern notion. It's part of the Enlightenment project. It's part of, there was a lot of good that came out of the development of the individual moral subject through Enlightenment thought. That's where individual human rights come from. It's a good thing to honor the individual. But is it a good thing to believe that essentially we are autonomous units? Newtonian physics, little autonomous atoms going around. Or do we need to think about a broader sense of what a human being is? A being in community, in relationship. I just think that's one of the things we need to throw out there to challenge. Are we essentially, is our fundamental right to pursue self-interest, or is our fundamental right to pursue the common good, which includes our self-interest?
Can't we say that human beings are this complex anyway, that there is an individual dimension, and there is a social dimension, and that those need to be kept in balance, and if either is short-circuited, then the person is not a healthy person.
I think we probably can, and that the social dimension is that which has been somewhat lost in the development of modern society. Move on to a second myth, a market myth with a whole ocean full of presuppositions about freedom, basically linking human freedom to market freedom. It's probably unrefutable that we all value freedom, and that freedom is a laden word and bears with it a lot of weight. We probably fought the Gulf War in part because we thought freedom was important. Well, as an Asian, that's what we heard.
Only a couple guys believed it, though.
Oh, only a couple guys believed it. My neighborhood believed it. There were yellow flags all over my neighborhood.
91% of the nation supported it.
Well, freedom, I think, in that context was the freedom to be able to buy gas for $1.50 or $1.50.
Freedom to have as much oil as
democratic freedom.
And the willingness to put 500,000 young Americans at risk to make sure we have cheap gas, including our own children.
And their families.
And the continuing embargo.
Okay, and the continuing embargo. So that, but I do think that gets at, you are getting back at the right to have, and I think freedom does get defined as the freedom to have, the freedom to consume at low cost whatever we want. Freedom as the freedom to consume and accumulate wealth without limits is integral to human freedom. What are the three freedoms in the what's in the Constitution?
Life, liberty, and the
pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of... What does liberty mean? Is it liberty? Is it freedom? Is it freedom to pursue wealth? I think we simply need to challenge that notion of freedom.
Actually, it was copied from a previous document which had life, liberty, and property.
Right, right. And that was undone. The pursuit. Yeah. That's very true. There is a tension throughout the history of this nation, especially in the early years, the tension between freedom to pursue wealth and equality. You can read it in the Founding Fathers, that there's an understanding that the freedom to pursue wealth unlimited jeopardizes equality. And there are many balancing acts and answers to that question. What about this part of freedom? Free markets, that is free trade and investment, and the freedom of choice to buy things enhances human freedom, and is in fact a necessary condition for human freedom to flourish. The freedom to consume. Don't we see it as, when we go into the supermarkets and see all different kinds of toothpaste and shampoo and food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then we look at supermarkets or stores in another country that have very few choices, we're glad we have the freedom.
No.
It makes me sick. I
can't
go to the grocery store.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't literally eat much.
There's more stress having
to
make choices between.
I literally have to go to the bathroom while I go grocery shopping.
Yeah.
It makes me sick. Uh-huh. So we eat 50 different kinds of stewed tomatoes, you know? So I'm going to get stewed tomatoes.
Well, one of the problems is that because there's so many choices, you start reading the prices on each one because you want, of course, get the cheapest one. So if there's only two you have to read, you're going to have more time than if you got 50, you've got to read the price for all 50 of them to figure out which is the cheapest. I don't consider that, even in the free market sense, that valuable.
Well, then there's the new improved. Right. And they're always doing something natural.
So I think that's part of a big capitalism is that we need to continue. If we don't continue to produce and continue to... send out these things in all kinds of different varieties, well then my little company of stewed tomatoes is going to die.
And that's probably true.
It is.
I mean, there's a lot of truth to some of the fears that are attached to that.
Yeah.
But I think that is real. And you talk to corporate executives, I've talked to corporate, high-level corporate people about what I'm saying, and one of the things they'll say is that this model of globalization is not only corporate-driven, but it's finance-driven. In other words, even corporations that want to produce goods and services are forced to look at Wall Street and what Wall Street is going to say. That their profits increase is more important than that they produce goods and services.
Yeah,
right. So the point I want to make here is that as we go through life now, we ought to look, whenever the word freedom is used, or free, and you hear it used a lot in relationship to late advanced global capitalism, think about what freedom is, how the moral weight that the word freedom is used, and see if it's used in a distorting way. Let me suggest a third myth, the myth of inevitability. And that's been alluded to a number of times here. According to this myth, corporate-driven globalization is evolutionary. It's a form of kind of manifest destiny. It's historically inevitable. That is, God ordained this kind of economic life. God has blessed America. America has promoted this form of corporate-driven capitalism and pushed it upon the world, and there aren't alternatives.
aren't successful.
And is there, or they're not successful?
And communism failed. That's true. Uh-huh. It was tried and it failed.
Uh-huh.
That's it, right?
That is the second clause of this myth, yeah. I do think. Someone in the back row.
No, oh. I was just waving.
I want to challenge the communism failed.
Okay.
I just came from Cuba and they seem to be doing okay.
Uh-huh.
And I would say there's a lot more hurt and anger on the streets of this part of North America than that part.
Uh-huh.
Well, there are many people in Cuba who are not doing okay.
And then you can ask why. Does it have to do with the U.S. embargo for the last 20 years?
Well, but then there's many people here.
To say that Cuba's doing worse than the United States would be a long stretch.
Mm-hmm.
So just because there are people who aren't happy there, now I have to say the United States or almost any government on earth has failed.
They sort of have to look at your metrics on something like that. I mean, how you define what okay is.
Mm-hmm.
And
but the world is so much worse.
They have fewer
digital alternative capitalism.
What about turning that notion on its head, that our success in our free market exchange and so forth is a result of our sinfulness,
mm-hmm.
not of our being
mm-hmm.
blessed by God.
Mm-hmm.
It's
interesting. It's hard to turn when we see in God we trust on our money.
Right.
But I think that this notion, I mean, how many of us, Soviet-style communism, quote-unquote, fail, how many of us haven't been susceptible to the myth that what are the alternatives?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that it's a powerful notion. What else is there other than corporate-driven capitalism?
For Zimbabwe, say,
mm-hmm.
I think there's a clear alternative.
Mm-hmm.
What the market would say, you focus on producing chrome
mm-hmm.
because you have chrome.
Mm-hmm.
Stake your whole future of your nation and of your people on fitting into that little niche in the whole global
mm-hmm.
economy,
mm-hmm.
and you will all prosper. So if the market goes down, or if there's some sort of change in how you build automobiles or something, so that chrome is not needed anymore,
mm-hmm.
or the price goes into
mm-hmm.
the cellar,
mm-hmm.
The whole country goes destitute.
Mm-hmm.
Another alternative
mm-hmm.
is really the way they were doing it before
mm-hmm.
capitalism came along, namely that Zimbabwe had a total,
mm-hmm.
a whole
mm-hmm.
economy,
mm-hmm.
which would support their people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people made shoes, and some people grew rice, and some people grew
mm-hmm.
potatoes,
mm-hmm.
and some people were government workers, and some people were teachers, and whatever happened on Wall Street, they could still sustain themselves. Now, you know, maybe a global economist would say, oh, but your gross national product is only $500 million, you are poor and primitive and backward,
mm-hmm.
and they ought to say, go to hell, we're happy, and everybody's eating, and our children are being educated,
mm-hmm.
and we don't need you, thank you.
So you're pointing to kind of an example of the fact that there are alternatives.
Yes.
And in fact, that Zimbabwe produced chrome and chrome alone is the operating mandate.
Right.
Of the global economy, because the corollary to free trade and investment, free markets, is economies of developing nations structured around export of few products. And that's the modus operandi that goes with this. And it is the exciting thing is that the option that you're suggesting, national or regional, and often it's not just Zimbabwe, but regional, production systems is an option that is promoted, discussed, thought on high levels by economists at grassroots levels. It's a viable option being promoted by many people, particularly Africans. So that cuts a little bit of a hole in the notion that there is no alternative to global corporate-driven capitalism.
However, what is the role of national debt and all of that,
mm-hmm.
because you can't
mm-hmm.
pay the national debt by growing potatoes.
But you would not have a national debt if you didn't.
No, but if you had the debt, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is,
yeah,
here's the debt.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. the squeeze is being put on to pay that debt.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in Latin America, mm-hmm. forget about it. They can't do anything
mm-hmm.
but whatever
mm-hmm.
the World Bank tells them to do because they've got this debt over their heads.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and they were conned and lied to get into that debt.
Sure.
I mean, they were a bunch of young graduates with BMAs were sent down to South America and to tell the leadership in those countries that they could virtually have the money for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We've got, and the North American banks were sitting with a whole lot of excess capital, and here was a marvelous new market, and they went down and just seduced people.
So what you've pointed to, first Roger and then, I can't remember,
but
you've pointed to another piece, and we really should have a big blackboard up here that I could write on, because we're mapping out the dynamics in corporate-driven capitalism. We've looked at free trade and investment moves. We've looked at the debt that, as you rightly describe, was falsely entered into. We won't go into all of that. And we're looking at the way that debt, the repayment of the debt, demands that the highly indebted countries produce crops for products for export to repay the debt. And then that money goes to repay the debt. And this is why in one of the earlier sessions, we could reread it now, the Methodist bishop that I read you, the Methodist bishop in Africa, Bishop Bernardino, I don't speak French, so I can't say it right, says that millions of African children die of malnutrition to ensure that children of the North can overeat. Africa is forced to drain its major resources to serve the debt. The debt is full of blood. It's true. Now, again, we could lie down and die. We could just think this is hopeless. We could also say that the church and other religions, not only Christianity, but also other religions on this globe, have been coming together in the last few years to say 50 years of debt is enough, to work towards a jubilee. And mind you, the World Bank has been impacted, the IMF less so, but has been impacted. The move to forgive the debt is a powerful move and is going to bear fruit. So certainly one way for Christian people in community to enter into this is to jump on to the train, the Jubilee train. You know, call Bread for the World, get their packet on debt reduction, and teach it in our churches, do workshops in it, and start writing to our legislators. There is legislation all over the place now around debt forgiveness. I say that not to be Pollyanna, but to say that religious people throughout the world are having an impact on one of the fundamental mechanisms of murder on Earth today, which is the debt that many developing nations suffer.
The cost of two-step bombers
uh-huh.
would pay off the whole debt.
Would pay off the whole debt. Well, this is the kind of thing to put in our letters to our legislators. So we were on the myth of inevitability. We've gotten into a map of the global economy. We've seen how things are interrelated, which is very good. And we've also seen that there are hopeful moves. The point to just come back to before we move on from that one is that we better, in our minds and in our reading, in our learning, refute the myth that things have to go on this way. That manifest destiny included not only the conquest of the Americas, but the conquest of the world through free markets.
I think we have to do that, because let's say we forgave the debt, say
uh-huh.
there was a jubilee, and we didn't change the ideology. Well,
mm-hmm.
then the next year there would be loans and more debt. I mean, we just start up again for another 50. I mean, if you don't change the belief system, you're just going to repeat it.
Well, I think there's truth to that, and there are many little subsets of this. The myth of manifest destiny, which I attach to the myth of inevitability, is very, very strong.
Oh, yeah.
If you read the documents produced by the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations, which was an elite group of statesmen and business executives in the 40s, a think tank designing foreign policy for the Americas, you can read the documents. They were classified, and now you can get a hold of them. And you can read what they say. They map out the quote-unquote grand area, which is the part of the world that the U.S. needs to control economically and militarily in order to do two things. Have sufficient markets for our goods and get sufficient resources in order that our economy continue without internal change. In other words, for capitalism to go on and keep on producing the American dream, we needed to control a certain part of the world for its markets and for its resources. So this is a kind of manifest destiny that we have the right to do that. So I'm just saying it's deeply rooted and we ought to question it. A fourth myth, and I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on that. We've talked about it before. It's a fundamental precept of neoclassical economics, and that is that economic life can be separated from the moral life. That economics works according to mathematical models, and that we don't need to question the morality of economic life. In other words, we don't need to question, for instance, the morality of corporate life, the morality of this person making 400 times what this person makes. That's something we need to question. And finally, the myth that we talked about in the second session, that free markets create wealth which trickles down to raise the living standards of all. And we kind of beat that one up a lot in the second session, and I think it's really worth studying and getting into and knocking holes in that. Because this is the myth that's most explicitly stated. This is what you really hear and you read in the documents that support free market economy.
Question.
Yes.
Why do we believe there's truth in that? I mean, what around us would give us...
Yeah, what's the proof?
Why do we believe that?
I think partly we believe it because certain forms of statistics say it. We've been living according to trickle-down economy since at least Reagan's years, and the average income and the average wealth of Americans has increased tremendously. So when you cite those averages, I mean, literally, you can read it. The average income of, or Australia too, of the income of the average Australian is X times what it was 15 years ago. And people read that statistic without critical vision, which is one of the tasks of a human being, critical vision, and fail to note that the mean or the median income is vastly less. So I think we believe it statistical manipulation and failure to... And the fact that our media says it, you look at growth figures, the GNP has grown.
Just on the surface, you know, the unemployment rate's going down consistently. Yeah. I mean, without analyzing those figures, that indicates that more people are working in this country and it's a trickle-down effect.
That's a very good statistic. Little do we know that unemployment figures don't include the people who are so underemployed that they can't make a living.
Right.
But it's not necessary that they have anything. I mean, as long as you've got a significant majority of people who are affluent and happy with their life, and in America something like 71% of the population is happy with their life, economically, then they are submissive. And if the resources that are, and the markets which are needed to keep capitalism going are all overseas, we can ignore them.
We can. I mean, we can. But learning to see through what is claimed is one of our tasks. And I think seeing through the manipulation of you asked why we believe it. I think we believe it because of the manipulation of facts and figures and a kind of ideology that we live by.
But why should we care as long as we're all right? And our children and grandchildren are all right.
Well,
which we don't know.
Yeah, well, our grandchildren aren't all right. They won't live like
we generation.
There won't be any air or water or to sustain life as we know it.
Or modern technology will find new ways.
That's good. That is another myth.
I think that's one of the myths, that technology will solve the problem.
Uh-huh. I think there's very much truth to that. Yes. Ron.
When the petroleum is gone, they will find a new form of energy.
That is.
When the aluminum is gone, they'll find something else.
Ron.
Going back to you, one of your two foundational questions.
Yes.
Why do we as people of faith go along with this or acquiesce to this?
Uh-huh.
For each one of those, there is also a theological premise or doctrine that supports it.
That was, you don't know this, but that's what I was, one of the things I was going to ask. But
okay.
Say more.
So to me, it's not so much that I'm, you know, I personally, or we generally are persuaded by these myths as much as we are by the theology that has developed and surfaced in the church throughout the ages to support these myths and to bless these myths. And our task, you know, Jesus didn't take on Rome as much as he took on the Jewish theology, and it seems to me our task in conjunction to this, mm-hmm. is also to deal with all of the ideologies of our theology that support this.
Well, let's go down that path a little bit, given that part of our contribution is to look at how theology has contributed to this crisis and look at how theology can help us get out of it. Would you mind considering that question a little bit? What are some of the theologies behind here? My question to you to look at that is not at all rhetorical, because I'm writing both a dissertation and a book on this, and that's one of the things I haven't started developing much yet. So I would really love your you notice I got my pen out, I'm gonna take notes. No, but I do think that point is well taken. What theological notions, theology, how we believe about God and God's relationship to creation, support or refute some of these myths?
Well, one of the things that's problem is the economic life separated from the moral life, mm-hmm. and that most of our theology has to do with the moral life separated from economic life,
uh-huh.
in spite
okay.
of the fact that Jesus talks mostly about money.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's mm-hmm. a good point. Someone pointed out that if you cut out all the parts of the Bible in which Jesus or the Hebrew Bible condemn economic inequity, you have a shredded Bible. Shredded.
And in our own history, related to that one, yes, Luther addressed a lot of things about economics, but in his overall construct with the two-kingdom theory, which we have so utilized to our advantage or disadvantage, supports that. That there's this kingdom of spirituality over here, uh-huh. and there's king secular world over here, in which mm-hmm. economic life and everything else mm-hmm. operates, mm-hmm. and they are not the same kingdom. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They operate side by side.
For how many people is that the way you learn Lutheran theology?
Oh, yeah.
In the world, but not of the world.
Yeah. Pastors were not to speak up on social issues.
That's right.
That was
the very premise. It was Luther's two kingdom. You don't have to deal with that. Just deal with the spiritual matters, and the rest will take care of itself.
You teach the truths from the Bible, but you don't get involved.
That's like I married at Luther's wedding ceremony, where you got married outside the secular world, and then you got blessed inside the church by the spiritual world.
Well, I think that those two things are intimately related. What you just said, that we read Luther's two kingdoms as saying the economic life and the moral life are separate, and also that pastors ought not to address political economic issues. Now, and I'll point to you in just a minute. Let me say that. That is Lutheranism, as we know it in North America and Europe. But it's not Luther. I firmly believe that it's a misrepresentation of Luther. And you can read Luther. That's what we're going to do tomorrow, in part, in our session. Look at some of the stuff in Luther that refutes this. But specifically about that pastors ought not to talk about political and economic issues. And you know how they get criticized when they do. I'm married to one of them. That does, and many people support him.
And he gets it.
But Luther, in one of his treatises that's not translated into English, you can't read it. I mean, it's in English by people, but it's not in Luther's works. Admonishes pastors to preach against economic injustice. It's called the admonition to preachers to preach against usury. He admonishes preachers to take on. Early modern capitalism and condemn it. So it's interesting.
Yeah, and I want to say I'm Catholic, and Catholic has a very, one of the biggest kept secrets is Catholic social teaching. And the Pope, he speaks out against capitalism, he speaks out against the military conflict, but it doesn't trickle down to the person in the pew. And that's really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. The American bishops do pretty good.
They do very well, but it doesn't get to your rank and file Catholic.
But it's powerful. It's a powerful tool for the moral life of Christian people, some of Catholic social teaching.
The ideology of inevitability. There is a theology, which I grew up with. I'm but a stranger here. Heaven is my home. Uh-huh. Just slide through this life. Don't get too rattled by it. Let things go on as they are. Uh-huh. They're going to happen that way anyway. Our main concern is to get on to another place.
And spend your time in church and praying and,
yep.
loving your neighbor and don't screw your neighbor's wife and you're okay.
Yep, that's right.
What you need to do is get to heaven.
Of course, the Ten Commandments. A lot of people just hold on to those Ten Commandments.
But But that is an inevitability that I'm at a stranger here.
Yeah.
Heavens is my home.
So is that related to some Christian popular notions about the nastiness of politics, that we're not supposed to be political creatures?
It's the survival of the institution of the church. I mean, you can be a privileged court chaplain if you don't. I mean, you can say the king shouldn't be sleeping around so much, but you can't say he's getting his money unjustly, or you won't be the court chaplain anymore.
Okay, so
don't rile the waters. You know, if you're going to be a successful pastor, you don't dabble in anything that's going to be controversial.
When Nixon was going to go to China, he invited in a whole auditorium full of church leaders, all fundamentalists, not one mainline preacher, because we were no longer the court chaplain because of our opposition to the war in Vietnam.
Okay, no, this is true. What you all are saying is, and I think I'd like to lead us a slightly different direction now, because there is truth to this. I mean, I think we've all experienced it probably in this room. As a pastor, when you take on the powers that be they economic or military, you're likely to feel the burn. I always feel, having been an incredible critic of the church, that when we critique the church, we also note the opposite. And that is that the church also contains pastors and lay people who dare to challenge. And I think we have to remember those less prominent voices, that they exist, or we slip into only condemning the church. But I think y'all are pointing to something that I wasn't going to talk about, but I think is important, and it's the notion of the political, and that theology has given it a bad rap. But think about it. We know in the Genesis story we're created for community. We know we're created to tend the earth. We read throughout the Bible that we're created to serve the well-being of all. And the only way to do those things as beings in community is political life. In other words, shaping how decisions are made and resources used. It seems to me that Christians and Jews, if anybody, are called to be political creatures. That's part of our calling, to have a say in the shaping of common life. So I think the theological notion that somehow politics is secondary to the life of faith has been promoted and is not biblical. Were we not created for community, or were we not created to tend and live towards the great shalom, then we wouldn't be created for political life. But we are created with those mandates. So I would like to just hold up that as another theological problem.
That's just the great debate and great divide.
Pardon me?
Is to save souls or to live towards?
Oh, I see, okay. So salvation. Okay, yeah, you're right. That's another theological thing. We're not called to tend the well-being of all. We're called to save souls.
Save souls.
Okay.
Well, even when we drift into the well-being of others, we again, using that word, anesthetize ourselves. The congregation that will readily support a homeless program between you, maybe some of you are involved in this. You know, 12 churches will go together, and each church takes a homeless group of families for a week. And that's great, and that's good, but to do that without dealing with the structures and the attitudes within that community, which are creating that, is to, using again that analogy of taking the people out of the drowning river, the ones that are drowning in the river, rather than going up to see what the hell is going on with the bridge.
But it's not a bad beginning.
No, it isn't.
Sensitizing.
Yeah, and sometimes it goes beyond that. But it's been my experience that that is all we want. Yeah. And we don't need to go further.
And it makes us feel like good people.
We just become numb. It's good enough for us. Yeah. We're doing the mandate. And don't bother us with these other things that involve the powers that are uncomfortable to deal with.
There's a famous quote.
Roger, and then in the back row?
We do that in our county. And my first, in the church that I go to, my first response to it is, what are you talking about? Homeless in Greene County, Ohio? We don't have any cities here. And then they started coming in. And we rotated among all the churches. And it was really kind of splendid, actually. Because, it again, it's sensitizing people. So it's an incredible first step. Mm-hmm.
It is a good first. Both points are absolutely true. It's an incredible first step. As people of critical sight and prophetic vision and a will to live toward the new creation, then we take the step further. And we also need to come back to what Candace said. Maybe not even anesthetized, but feeling powerless, muted, people say, dwarfed. So that's why we need to hold up critical seeing and digging into alternatives. And I want to take two more comments, and then I want at least 3 or 4 minutes to point to some alternative principles. In the back row here and then here.
Yeah, I want to just bring up the question, you know, what effect on American Christianity has come from the notion of separation of church and state? You know, not separation of church and state as we know it today, because today I think most Christians see it as a way the government is keeping religion out of schools, which is not the inception of that idea. Was by the pilgrims who landed here, who were deeply spiritual, who were Christian, and wanted it as a way to keep the government out of the churches, you know? And so that's where American Christianity came from, you know, for this place of fear of union between politics and the church, because the experience from England was that when you start bringing too much politics into the church, then you lose your ability to freely practice your religion. So there's this fear from the standpoint of the early Christians of politics, and they want to keep them out of the church.
So you've pointed out how we've kind of flipped. We've used the separation and flipped it to serve the opposite purpose.
Yeah, now it's we're keeping us from being policymakers. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That goes back digging into.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was going to dwell a little bit on the point of just sort of the problems that we see and how we band-aid them, because we really don't. I mean, I think maybe it's human nature or whatever, but we know. I mean, I think we all kind of have an idea of what we're going to find if we keep going.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and who wants to open that can of worms?
Mm-hmm.
So by bringing a few people here and there, that's good. You know, by making a few gun laws, that's a good, you know, we'll put a band-aid over that, but... Is, you know, where's the bottom line? Where are we really at? And I mean, I really think there's a fear. And kind of this may go along with some of the other things that we're really afraid to really take that leap and that step to solve these where they need to be solved, to go into it and start from the core.
Well, your point, I mean, you've made a couple of really fundamental insights there. I think that the fear of going to see why the babies are falling into the river, does everyone know that? You mentioned, your father Alex mentioned the notion of, why do we just pull the babies that are in the river out? Why don't we go around the bin and see who's dropping them in the river?
Yeah.
The fear of doing that is real. It opens up so many things. Where will I have time? What will my kids do? Blah, blah, blah. A myriad of things. And so maybe that's one of the things that we take away grappling with. That fear to become richly political people, addressing the sources. There are so many reasons not to.
Yeah.
And there are so many reasons to and resources for. One thing that I'll say without any question in my mind is, you don't do it alone.
Yeah.
You do it in communities of various kinds, faith communities, political activist communities. You find good organizations, but I'm not going to give answers. I'm going to say I honor the statement that you made, and that I think one of the challenges we have is to lay out there with clear sight all of the reasons not to go beyond charitable response. There are many reasons not to. And then put those out there and deal with them. And address them with other people, because they will sabotage us forever if we do not see them clearly and address them. So thank you. Yes.
And I think one of the greatest things that keeps us from getting off of the pew and doing it is not a lot of argumentation or rationalizations. It's, in my opinion, in what I have seen, people are exhausted and they're fatigued and they're on that fucking rat race.
Yeah.
And why is that? That one statement that you had on there, the ideology. We are so busy trying to sustain, prop up our the consequences of consumerism, mm-hmm. that we do not have time. And if we had some time, what do? We take our kids to 14 soccer games and three other things during the week, and there's no time. And so not only does it destroy purpose and what the other one was, but it disables. I can't because I'm tired.
So that is very...
And my marriage is falling apart.
Yeah.
I'm going to defend going to the soccer game, however. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going to the soccer game. Uh-huh. I think it's the increasing cost of living that is driving us to have two incomes, full-time incomes into the household to cover all of the cost of the baseball games we're going to, the plays, the theater, the things that we choose to do. But I still value going to take my kids.
Well, okay, let's...
Well, I have something to say about that.
What if the symphony were free like the soccer game?
Yeah.
That's another question.
But where are the free seats at the Safeco Field for those who can't afford it?
Right. There are none.
There are none.
So, let it help.
Jump right in.
Did you say to me to jump right in?
Yes.
This is a rich discussion. And my caution, as I said before, being a woman who believes she has lived in powerlessness, despair, hopelessness, I fear it. And I don't want us to end with only seeing how powerless, dwarfed, muted, overwhelmed our lives are. And we are almost out of time. And we're not going to go further here. So I would challenge all of us to take this conversation in the rest of our times and conversations to look at one thing we know. One thing we know is the end of the story. You know, maybe we've talked about the pit, and we haven't gotten to talk about the way out very much, other than seeing critically. But the end of the story is the promise of the resurrection, that all things will be made new, and that we're not called to make it happen, we're called to work toward making it happen. I really value holding on to the end of the story. And then if the story ends that way, there are paths to get there. So our task is to find those paths. Now, there are more alternatives being worked on and talked about than all of us know about. On the micro level, and we're certainly seeing that in the affluenza discussion, ways for families and communities to live differently. And on the macro level, as you brought up, people in Zimbabwe and sub-Saharan Africa are fighting for regional economies rather than being pulled into the free market global economy. There are alternatives around. I wanted to throw out a few principles, and we won't spend a lot of time on them, that I've been gathering for the macro level. We'll skip this one for now. I mean, it's the opposite of who we are as homo economicos. We're not just, that's what modern man is called. Economic man. We are rational beings, and the highest form of rationality is the pursuit of self-interest measured by financial gain. That's the definition of modern man according to economic theory. So one alternative is to refute that. We are beings in community. This is the claim of our Christian life, of our Christian faith, and we are perhaps competitive but also cooperative, imbued with the spirit to live toward the great shalom. So we can refute homo economicos. A second principle that I just love, and this was given to me by a debt warrior, a warrior against the debt, those who reap the benefits pay the costs. That would transform economic life. The corporate world now is reaping the benefits of, for instance, exploitation of resources or polluting the earth, but not paying the costs. If the costs had to be paid, business would operate differently. If you reap the benefit of driving an SUV, you pay the cost. The cost has to do with sucking up gas. So I really love this little principle. Another one is that freedom is inseparable from accountability. Now, this is what we were talking about yesterday, the unaccountability of the decision makers. So that decisions to... Those who make decisions about public life are accountable to the public. In other words, corporate CEOs can't design the constitution of a global economy. accountability is non-existent there. So the notion of there is no freedom without accountability is a principle to me. And we could go into those in more depth, but we don't have time. The freedom must be balanced with equity. And this, again, is a long debate in U.S. history. And we are in the free market economy. We are allowing freedom to take precedence over equity. But if we value equity, economic equity and power equity, as much as freedom, then we have to temper the freedom to pursue self-interest. Another principle that is thrilling to me is to draw upon the Greek for the word economy, to look at the purpose of economic life. According to economic theory, and you can read this in any textbook, the purpose of economic life, of the economy, is to produce goods and services for human consumption. That's what the economy is about. Now, you can think about that in a lot of ways. For human consumption, overconsumption is destroying our earth. But think about economy. The Greek word for economy is oikonomia, which refers to the great community, the great household, you know, home economics, managing the household, the great household of creation. So the purpose of economic life is managing the great household of creation according to certain values. That's a very different purpose. The same word oikonomia, that's the root of economics, is also the root of ecology and ecumenics. So we see hints of a different perception of what the economy is to be about. So instead of having our economy judged by increasing GDP, increasing average income, what if we judge it? What if our society radically changes to judge economic life by how the household is managed, the resources, how the weakest are surviving, a different purpose for economic life? Those are just five suggestions of many kind of macro principles, ways of reorienting the notions by which we live, reorienting the myths by which we live. We're out of time. I want to summarize with one paragraph to move on to tomorrow. My point today has been this. Moral power, the power to live toward love and the choice of life, is disabled by deceptive and distracting myths that function as blinders. Our capacity to see what could be is crippled by our inability to see what is, and our passion for justice is squelched before it's even born. To expose the illusions, the myths, is a step toward regaining vision. As Rosa Luxemburg once said, the most revolutionary act is and continues to be always to say out loud what is. Mm-hmm. And I really love that quote. Mm-hmm. That's a critical function of the Christian moral life. It's been the aim of this hour together and the past 3 hours to expose a few critical illusions by which corporate-driven globalization is painted as good for life on this earth. Clearer vision ought serve the purpose of helping people from all of Earth's great faith traditions reorient our economic life to support sustainable Earth community for generations to come. So this is the purpose of digging into myths, to move toward a different reality, not just to wallow in the horrors of the myths by which we live. So thank you for sharing in this time of grappling together. And we can stay for further conversation, but for the purpose of the tape now, the session's over.